sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Dr. Ron Kronish, a pioneer of interfaith work in Israel and the author of the new book, The Other Peace Process, Interreligious Dialogue, A View from Jerusalem. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim, Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The long run of Jewish fall festivals is finally concluded with the celebration of Simchat Torah last week, and we've entered the holiday-free zone that lasts all the way up until Hanukkah. There's even a special name for the month that begins this week, Cheshvan, the single month in the whole Jewish calendar that contains no holidays. It is called Mar Cheshvan, literally the bitter month of Cheshvan, bitter because there are no celebratory festivals to interrupt the mundane dailiness of life. But if you happen, like me, to be in the professional Jewish business, there's something refreshing about the conclusion of this month-long overload of holiday happenings. After the non-stop glut of festivals, celebrations, fasts, and feasts, it's actually a little bit of a relief, a machaya, to get back to something akin to regular life. Don't get me wrong, I love the Jewish holiday season, and each festival has its own meaning and beauty. Each explores an important aspect of ritual and communal life. Every single festival, from Slichot through Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, from Sukkot to Shmini Atzeret to Simchat Torah, has something unique to teach us about how to live life well and meaningfully. But while this is an exhilarating period filled with festivities and people, it's also an exhausting time with many, many additional demands and requirements for a rabbi or a cantor or both, and even for the ordinary observant Jew. When we finally settle down to just regular Shabbat once a week, it's a kind of genuine delight. I guess at some point you really can get too much of a good thing. In any case, as we move into the more normal parts of the Jewish year, our Torah reading cycle begins again. Yesterday, we chanted the great portion of Bereishit, Genesis. This coming week, we'll read the story of Noah and the epic of the flood. While some years this seems like an ancient type story without contemporary resonance, that is not the case this year. In the past couple of months, we've had a flood of biblical proportion in Houston, Texas, and similarly colossal natural disasters in Puerto Rico and in Mexico, plus a near miss in Florida, and now there are wildfires burning up large swaths of California. Natural disasters are not just some archaic memory from an antique past. Instead, they have been literally flooding across our news feeds and social media accounts without cessation since the middle of last summer, considerably more than just 40 days and 40 nights. Which raises an important question. If God is good, and God has authority and power over the natural world that God created, why do such things occur? Why do natural disasters like floods wash away innocent human beings and animals with such frequency? Well, there is a practical answer and a theological one to this conundrum. I'll begin with the practical answer. The answer to why do bad floods, hurricanes, earthquakes, and destructive wildfires happen to good people goes like this. Cataclysmic natural events, like those that impacted so many people over the past few months, have always been a part of the world God created. They're in the ecosystem. When there were no human beings, or very few, these naturally occurring events, like tornadoes, volcanic eruptions, tsunamis, hurricanes, and so on, affected the landscape and the wild animals who lived on it, but generally speaking, they weren't disasters in a meaningful way, because in our human-centric view of things, no people were harmed and no property with economic value was damaged in the making of those, you know, natural events. As people began to spread out on the land, in Genesis' phrase, and multiply, they also moved into areas where these kinds of natural events caused them great harm. We built cities on the shore of seas that could explode with tidal waves. We created settlements in the shadows of great volcanoes that erupted and then annihilated the residents below. We planted vineyards in arid regions, watered the ground, and when the foliage became dense and dried out, it was perfect fuel for wildfires, and so on. We moved to islands that were always in the path of hurricanes. We created major cities in the floodplains of great rivers and oceans. And then we were shocked that natural disasters struck us in these vulnerable locations. I realize this isn't much biblical consolation to those who have lost relatives, homes, businesses, pets, and lives to flood or fire or earthquake in recent months. But the truth is, God doesn't cause these naturally occurring events to become disastrous for human beings. We do that by insisting on placing ourselves in what can only be reasonably described as harm's way. And that's without even acknowledging the ways we change our own landscape through reconstruction, or by creating situations in which disasters are more likely to happen, or the ways that by polluting the environment we help bring about some of those physical changes that then put us directly at risk. Of course, we must respond with human compassion and support for the many people caught up in these awful situations in Houston, in Puerto Rico, in Mexico, in California. I've personally lived through wildfires that destroyed the homes of many people I knew well and cared about deeply. There's almost nothing more devastating than losing your home and all of your possessions and pets in a sudden, terrible episode, let alone losing family members. We have to help and to care. But we also need to realize that God is not to blame for such things. It is our own choice where we build our homes and where we decide to live, which also makes it our responsibility to help those people whose lives are so damaged by the human choices we all make. Our responsibility, not God's. On a lighter note, and to play us in on this fall morning, here's a Sephardic classic song, Tres Hermanicos, performed by the intriguing group Nedudim, which mixes genres and styles in a unique musical way.
Tres Hermanicos. Tres hermanicas son, tres hermanicas eran, tres hermanicas son. Casadas, blanca de rosa y ramas de flor, las dos eran casadas, la una se te perdió, las dos eran casadas, la una se te perdió. De rosas y ramas de flor, su padre con vergüenza, ¿a dónde es la mía? Su padre.
That was Tres Hermanicos, a Sephardic classic song performed by the ensemble Nedudim. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Rabbi Ron Kronish, is a pioneer, perhaps the pioneer of interfaith work in Israel, author of the new book, The Other Peace Process, Interreligious Dialogue, A View from Jerusalem. Find out what it's like to connect with people of different religious views in a land where every religious issue is fraught with tension and the potential for violence. And yet, dialogue continues, we get to know each other, and, well, it develops. Hear all about it when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Learn to make challah at the 4th Annual Tucson Mega Challah Bake on Thursday, October 26th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Tucson JCC. This Mega Challah Bake is in collaboration with Chabad Tucson and sells out, so please register early. Registration closes on October 23rd or when we sell out, so please register today. Learn to make, knead, and braid beautiful, delicious challah for your Shabbat table. Bring your mom, your daughters, and your friends. A great family event for women and girls ages 9 and older. For tickets, go to megahallahtucson.com.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning our guest, Rabbi Dr. Ron Kronish, perhaps the most important Jewish figure working in interreligious dialogue over a number of years. He has a new book out called The Other Peace Process, Interreligious Dialogue, A View from Jerusalem. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
You know, there's a great deal of conflict. We hear all about religious conflict around the world. We don't tend to hear nearly as much about religious concord across the barriers or the differences of belief. Tell us a little bit about what involved you in this work in the first place and why you believe it's important.
I got involved about 26 years ago. In 1991, I established an organization in Israel called the Interreligious Coordinating Council, which grew and developed into the largest interfaith organization in Israel. It was a coalition of more than 60 organizations participating. We did this in the early 90s I call it a supplement to the peace process.
Right.
And we call it interreligious dialogue as a form of peace building. And the idea is to work with different people of religious groups in Israel, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, Israelis, and Palestinians to find non-governmental ways to see if we can live in peace together. And we've been doing it ever since, so it's more than 25 years now.
For those of us who love this kind of work, it seems in some ways the greatest expression of v'ahavta re'acha kamocha, loving and supporting your neighbors you love yourself. Not everybody views it that way. What's been the greatest challenge?
The greatest challenge we face in interreligious dialogue in Israel is that we're trying to do dialogue between people of different religions in the midst of an ongoing conflict that doesn't look like it's going to be resolved very soon. So the lack of political progress in the last 20-some years has made the dialogue more challenging and more complicated.
You've worked extensively in Muslim-Jewish dialogue in Israel, working with a number of important people. What's the most fulfilling part about that? Where do you see the most hope?
So I found a lot of hope, particularly in working with Muslims in Israel who are, first of all, interested in dialoguing with Jews because we're citizens of the same country. And secondly, have a worldview of Islam, which is not the one we read about in the newspapers every day. And I was gratified to meet Muslims who have modern religious ideas of Islam as an ethical and just religion that I didn't know about before.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Dr. Ron Kronish when we return in just a few moments, talking about interreligious dialogue in Israel. We'll be back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
You have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2jewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at 2jewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You recently came back from a trip to Eastern Europe, and we talked about Odessa, an extraordinary Jewish community there, and what's left now. You also went to Kiev.
Right. So Kiev, apart from being the capital of Ukraine, is also a city in which you cannot tell that you're in a country that's at war. There's this major shooting war between Ukrainians and Russians in the eastern part of Ukraine. Geographically, it's fairly far away from Kiev, and apparently psychologically it is too. There's no visible friction between Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers in Kiev, and the city is about half and half, or maybe even two-thirds Russian speakers and one-third Ukrainian speakers. But most people are functionally bilingual, and they certainly don't take umbrage if a foreigner addresses them in Russian. You know, it's better than nothing. Kiev at one point had, according to some reports, as many as 600,000 Jews, which is huge.
Enormous.
Other reports say 400,000. But
so either that's way, a lot of Jews.
Half a million plus or minus 20%.
Yeah, by contrast today, the second largest Jewish community in America is the Southern California, Los Angeles, and it's about 500,000 or 600,000 Jews. So, I mean, lots and lots of people.
Right. So the interesting question is, what happened to the Jews of Kiev, and what's that community like today? So Kiev was the site of this very famous butchering grounds for Nazis called Babi Yar, which was a ravine in what is today a beautiful park. Back then in the early 1940s, it was really slightly outside the city. Now it's in the city, but not near the city center. It's kind of still vaguely on the outskirts, but it's definitely in the metro area. And people who have no sense of history at all, like teenagers go and walk there hand in hand, and mothers walk their babies, and people walk their dogs. It's a beautiful park with a lot of different memorials to different groups of people who were killed there. I mean, just like with the rest of the Holocaust, Jews were not the only victims. Even if the overwhelming majority of victims was Jewish, there were also leftists and journalists and trade unionists and even members of a particular football team were executed there.
Homosexuals, you can run down the list.
Right. So today in Kiev, the estimates of the community range, and this is a pretty incredible range, once again, from like 20,000 to 100,000. And nobody can really agree. It's like, what's the population of Istanbul? Somewhere between 12 and 20 million.
Yeah.
You know, nobody really knows, because there's no longer a law requiring that people be registered or affiliated with a particular religious community. So people can be non-affiliated, non-registered, and not on anybody's mailing list. There are two large active synagogues and a number of smaller minyans and chavurot and whatever around the city. It's a very big city. And as one of the Ukrainian waiters who served us in a Georgian restaurant said, everybody here has at least one Jewish grandparent. So, you know, depending on how you define what being Jewish is, in that sense, everybody in Kiev is at least
a little bit Jewish. Yeah, like everybody's partially Jewish.
Right.
You know, a friend of ours, Gingy, who started the first Reform congregation there in Kiev. I mean, there's an incredibly vital life, Jewish life springing up in Kiev again. We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And for the first time in a long time, we don't say Chag Sameach or Lishana Tova or Gmar Chatima Tova.
We can still, you know, wish each other, may we have like a beautiful year.
A beautiful year is a good wish. So now that the holidays are behind us, what's your favorite holiday memory that you'd like to share, or your favorite tradition, just looking back over the last few weeks?
Yeah, since this will be my... I think my fifth or sixth year in a row that I didn't have my high holidays in Israel, because a year before we came here, we celebrated high holidays in Prague, because it was my first year of my brother doing his shlichut there. So
in Prague, which is a nice place too.
Yeah, the, mamash. So the beautiful, beautiful tradition that I miss mamash very much is that at the end of Yom Kippur, all the family of the all my uncles and aunts from my mother's side will go to my grandmother that she's still alive. And at the end of the fast, after we will have something, first of all, arak and a cookie and then a meal, they will build the sukkah at the backyard of my safta. And then at the end of Sukkot, we will all get together and break down the sukkah. And, you know, everything go to it, to its place, and it's like a beautiful tradition. And, of course, we have another beautiful meal that my grandma will cook. This is like a beautiful memory.
That is really lovely. You know, I always think about, like, the holidays in Israel are so different because, you know, nobody's working. And, you know, in America, when you go to holidays, you feel that sense when you're in the synagogue and then you walk out and life's going on normally. It, you know, it could be Yom Kippur and a Saturday, but there's soccer games on the field and all kinds of other pieces and things like that. So it's different. Do you miss being in Israel?
Definitely. And I think it goes with my appreciation to every Jew who lives outside of Israel, because in Israel, I think I told you once, you know, and forgive me, you can eat pork five times a day. And
not
you can,
me.
You
I don't eat pork five times a day.
So a person can eat pork and still feel so Jewish,
of
because
course.
Everything is so Jewish. And here you need to define your Jewish identity, I feel like, almost every day, because everything is so not Jewish. And in order to be you as a Jew, you definitely need to work very hard. So yeah, I miss this feeling that everything around me is chag, is holiday, and everyone dressed like white if it's Rosh Hashanah, and everyone will wish, you know, Shana Tova and Gmar Chatima Tova, even you know, if you never saw him before,
never met the person,
even if he's your big enemy, anyway, you will get, you know, a Shana Tova and Gmar Chatima Tova, and this is very special.
It is. It's something, that's the thing you just can't totally recreate, no matter how nice the Jewish community is elsewhere. Thanks so much, Rashad. We'll talk next week.
Toda rabbi.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. It's just after the holiday season. Towards the end of the Shabbos morning service, Rabbi Goldstein asks his congregation, "On Yom Kippur a few weeks ago, I asked you all to forgive your enemies. So, tell me, how many of you have forgiven your enemies?" Well, about 80% of the congregation holds up its hands. Rabbi Goldstein asks again, "Now come on, we can do better than that. Now, how many of you have forgiven your enemies?" Finally, everybody raises a hand, except one elderly man, Mr. Steinberg. Mr. Steinberg, it's so good to see you here today. Good Shabbos, says the rabbi. And you aren't willing to forgive your enemies? I don't have any, Mr. Steinberg replies gruffly. Mr. Steinberg, that's very unusual. How old are you? Says the rabbi. I'm 98 years old, he replies proudly. The congregation, oh, who's in Oz? Okay, Mr. Steinberg, says the rabbi, would you please tell us, how can a person live 98 years and not have a single enemy in the whole world? The old man slowly rises, faces the congregation, and says, I've outlived all the momsers. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You see, a momser is Yiddish for a jerk, only worse. And now, a word of Torah. This coming week in Temple, we read the great Torah portion of Noah. Noach, the most famous mariner in all history, a man who rode out the storm to end all storms in an ark. We know that the great tale is shared to one degree or another, the flood tale, by other ancient books of lore and legend, most notably the Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh, another guy who had to build a big boat in order to save humanity. You know, there's something inherently comic about being stuck on a boat with a large number of animals. It's the inherently ridiculous nature of trying to alert the world to imminent catastrophe, let alone the impossibility of making a substantive difference in improving human behavior ever. And somehow, that seems especially true when you're surrounded by barnyard animals. Well, we are pretty familiar with the text of Noah. God sees wickedness and corruption have spread through the world. Human beings are acting in ways that should have been predictable to an all-knowing deity. Lying, cheating, stealing, committing adultery, sending rude tweets, you know, the usual. In response, God decides to destroy the world in a great flood, rain falling for 40 days and nights, the whole of humanity drowned in deluge. One man alone is chosen to survive the flood because, the Torah text tells us in this week's portion, he was righteous in his generation. Noah, Noach in Hebrew, is chosen to carry the banner of humanity to the next generation. Gathering his family and two of each animal, plus seven pairs of each kosher animal, so they have something to eat and something to sacrifice to God, Noah builds an ark, loads the boat, and goes on not a three-hour cruise, but one long enough to float away every trace of the depravity of humanity. Eventually, Noah sends out first a raven and then finally a dove to see if the world is dry enough to land on. The dove brings back that famous olive branch. They land and exit the ark, and life begins again. Noah, we're told, was a righteous man in his generation, Tzadik Bedoro Tal, which doesn't necessarily make him a righteous man in every generation, but it does set a standard we might be able to live up to. If we can't necessarily succeed in becoming fully righteous for all time, at least we can strive to be righteous in our own times. Sometimes even that quest can seem absurd, even comical, but it remains our essential legacy. Like Noah, we all must try to perfect this challenging and often broken world, whether we do it with an ark or in much smaller, more practical ways, with simple mitzvot and acts of tzedakah, charity. There was a very good but long-forgotten Broadway musical called 2x2, based on the Noah story, and based also on a Clifford Odets play, The Flowering Peach. The play starred the late Danny Kaye, and this song from that show is about what happens when you finally get off the ark. It's called When It Dries.
Why are you so gloomy? We're alive and we're afloat. After 40 days and nights, it's shipshape on the boat. Look, the sun's come out again and turned a rosy red. How can you be gloomy when you think of what's ahead? It's gonna be some terrific place when it dries, you're gonna see wide and open space when it dries, It's gonna be some terrific place. You're gonna see wide and open space. We're gonna have such a human race when it dries. The greenery's gonna have a shine when it dries. When it dries, the world will be full and fat and fine. When it dries, when it dries, the greenery's gonna have a shine. The world will be full and fat and fine.
The best thing of all, it's one third mile when it dries.
Half a million growing things will spring up from the ground.
Half a million bodies will be floating all around.
Room to work and grow and build a company of men.
Think about how much we can contaminate again.
There's gonna be air beyond compare when it dries.
When it dries.
With drinkable water everywhere.
When it dries. When it dries. There's gonna be air beyond compare with drinkable water everywhere.
As long as you don't have people there when it dries.
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 To survive, we'll all live side by side in peace, caring for the animals and watching them increase.
Isn't it a miracle? A brand new world begins.
Think of all the fun we'll have
inventing brand new sins.
We're going to walk a righteous path when it dries. When it dries, remembering how he vents his wrath when it dries. We're going to walk a righteous path, remembering how he vents his wrath.
That when he got mad, we took some bath.
When it dries.
That was the song When It Dries from the old musical 2x2, music by one of the most successful of all Broadway composers, Richard Rodgers. He was, of course, Jewish. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Dr. Ron Kronish, will explain why interreligious dialogue is so crucial for Israeli society and for the peace of the whole Middle East. Find out when we return in a moment right here on To Jewish.
Learn to make challah at the 4th Annual Tucson Mega Challah Bake on Thursday, October 26th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Tucson JCC. This Mega Challah Bake is in collaboration with Chabad Tucson and sells out, so please register early. Registration closes on October 23rd or when we sell out, so please register today. Learn to make, knead, and braid beautiful, delicious challah for your Shabbat table. Bring your mom, your daughters, and your friends. A great family event for women and girls ages 9 and older. For tickets, go to megahallahtucson.com.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Cairo, the leaders of Hamas and Fatah signed an agreement theoretically reuniting the Palestinians, recreating a joint Palestinian authority. Hamas representatives will now be placed into Palestinian Authority positions in the West Bank, while the police system in Gaza will be rebuilt by Fatah. In theory, the Palestinian Authority, controlled by Fatah, will again have overall leadership over Gaza. The previously warring Palestinian factions have brokered such deals before, most notably back in 2011. That deal did not last, but there is some reason to believe this agreement has better prospects for durability and may perhaps create a united Palestinian group with whom Israel might be able to negotiate. We will see. At the UN, the Trump administration is planning to withdraw from UNESCO, the UN's cultural and educational agency, over UNESCO's bias against Israel. That decision is tied to the administration's attempt to cut funding to the cultural agency UNESCO, which it owes some $500 million to. That change could be announced as early as next week. If the Trump administration withdraws from UNESCO, it will be the second U.S. administration to take such a step. The Reagan administration quit UNESCO in the 1980s, and the U.S. rejoined it only 20 years later under George W. Bush. In 2011, under the Obama administration, the U.S. cut off most of its funding for UNESCO, this time over UNESCO's acceptance of Palestine as a member state. The Trump administration wants to exit the organization entirely, citing a number of recent resolutions that target Israel and its settlements, including a resolution which declared the city of Hebron in the occupied West Bank as a Palestinian World Heritage Site, and a resolution from October 2016 sharply critical of Israel's policies in Jerusalem. And in other news, in Stockholm, Sweden, Richard Thaler, professor at the University of Chicago, won the Nobel Prize in Economics for his pioneering work in the field of behavioral economics. The Nobel Committee announced the prize for Thaler. They said his research helped lead to changes in public policy, such as employees being automatically registered in programs that help them save for retirement. Thaler is Jewish, was born in East Orange, New Jersey. He said his work rested on the idea that in order to do good economics, you have to keep in mind people are human. Imagine that. Thaler's pioneering work was spurred by his collaboration with 2002 Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman, also Jewish, the psychologist who shared the economics prize in that year for beginning the work on behavioral economics with Israeli scholar Amos Tversky. Thaler's approach took on the then unassailable Chicago School of Economics that said that all economic choices people make are rational. Thaler demonstrated many of the choices we make are informed by our feelings, not just calculations. His research helps predict human economic decisions. While people often behave in irrational ways, Thaler has shown that they do so according to certain patterns. The 72-year-old economist, who made a cameo alongside Selena Gomez in the 2015 film The Big Short, joked that he would spend the $1.1 million award as irrationally as possible. Gotta like that. Thaler did say he'd continue his work in economics. With the Jewish recipients of the Nobel Prize Awards announced last week in physics and medicine, that brings the total number of Jewish Nobel laureates to, about a quarter of all Nobels ever awarded. In economics, the numbers are, frankly, ridiculous. Irrational, if you will. The Nobel Prize for Economics has only been awarded since 1970. In the 38 years of its existence, Jews have received it 29 times. Wow. In much less savory news, Harvey Weinstein, the co-founder of Miramax, a very successful independent studio, and co-chairman of the Weinstein Company, and one of the most powerful men in Hollywood, was fired by his company and enmeshed in a sexual assault scandal that continues to grow. A series of actresses, many prominent ones, models, singers, and journalists have accused Harvey Weinstein of inappropriate advances, ranging from propositioning them to sexual harassment to rape. There have been a number of financial settlements Weinstein and his company have paid to women over the years to cover up his actions. In addition to his career producing Academy Award-winning films and Tony Award-winning plays, Weinstein has also been a prominent financial supporter of politicians who are now seeking rapidly to distance themselves from him and to condemn his behavior. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Dr. Ron Kronish, who is an interreligious peace builder in Jerusalem, founder of organizations, and the author of the new book, The Other Peace Process, Interreligious Dialogue, A View from Jerusalem, just published this year. Tell us a little bit about what changes you've seen. You've been doing this, as you said, actively for more than 27 years. What changes have you seen in understanding, having dug into this process so deeply, and what changes do you see happening right now?
So the first change, I would say there are two changes that I saw. One was that when I began this, most of the people involved in the dialogue were Jews and Christians, and most of them were expats, that is, people from abroad, either the U.S., Germany, Australia, who were living in Israel for either for long term or short term. And one of the things I tried to do was to localize the dialogue and make it consist of people who who are more indigenous, so we reached out to local Christians and local Muslims, and not only people who come from abroad. The second change, I would say, is that Muslims were not involved in dialogue very much, either for fear or for lack of, you know, the culture of dialogue. You know, the Jewish-Christian dialogue is going on for 50 years, and so people kind of brought it to Israel, but the whole Jewish-Muslim one was new. So we kind of discovered and pulled out of the woodwork religious Muslims in Israel who were really interested in engaging in dialogue, and that has been I think the greatest achievement. And part of my work over the years, I've traveled to the United States several times with some of these my Muslim colleagues, and I've learned to encounter a whole different vision of Islam than is regularly discussed or regularly met, and it's been quite gratifying for me to know about this.
You know, sometimes in interreligious dialogue settings, it feels like we're talking to all the best people who really want to talk to us, and that's a wonderful experience and fulfilling. Those aren't the only people that need to be involved in this dialogue. How do you try to reach into the more difficult areas?
Right, good question. So, first of all, I want to be candid and say that we didn't reach the extreme fringes. In other words, like in the Jewish world, we didn't bring in ultra-Orthodox because they weren't interested, but we brought in, on the Jewish side, Reform, Conservative, Secular, Modern Orthodox, a great deal of diversity. And I would say in the Christian and Muslim side, we also reached out and we brought in Sufi Muslims and Modern Orthodox Muslims and secular Muslims, and the same with Christians. So one of the things we kind of discovered was a great diversity in the religions and cultures among ourselves and our neighbors. The other thing we did is we did a lot of work over the years with youth and young adults, and we often, and most of the time, I would say, reached out to new people for whom this was the first time in dialogue. You know, there's an expression called preaching to the choir.
Yes.
You talk to the same people all the time. We try to get beyond that. And one of the ways to do that was to work with young people. That would be youth in high school and young adults in college. And that was probably the most gratifying part of my work, because working with young people who are not as burned out, not as cynical, and don't have all the answers meant that these were people who were genuinely interested in hearing the stories of the other and getting to know them. And in doing that, I would say 95% of the people we brought in were totally new to the dialogue. And many of them are carried it on and went into work in different organizations that do this with younger people. So I think working with younger people was an important aspect of my work.
I've often thought that people mistake ignorance for hostility. You can't blame people that just don't know very much about each other, and you can fill in those gaps. What ways do you see as the most fruitful for helping people understand other religious traditions from a positive viewpoint?
In my work, we developed a kind of method of dialogue, which I describe in some detail in the book. And we brought people together for a long-term dialogue group. In other words, if you joined the dialogue, it wasn't come for a Sunday morning for an hour and, you know, have bagels and talk and smile and say nice things, but it was a year-long process which involved learning each other's texts, involved discussing the core issues of the conflict, and involved a lot of small group discussions where people could develop trust and be able to say difficult things. And I've always said that genuine dialogue is not just saying all the niceties, but to hear from the other side people things that you're not comfortable with, and often hearing from the first time and wince the first time, but you're ready to hear more and learn more. So we very much personalize the dialogue and not try to keep it from being simply an intellectual experience.
You know,
knowledge gaining was part of it, but it was not the whole thing.
So some of it's just people being able to tell their stories, because that personalizes the experience.
Yes, a lot of it is what we call personal narrative. People getting to know each other as people. In our part of the world, where people are very easily demonized. This was an important step, we felt, of really getting to hear people's personal stories. But we also, once we built trust in people, we talked more about the political and the historical narratives, which made things very difficult and complicated. Most Jews, Israeli Jews, have never heard the Palestinian narrative, and most of the Palestinians have never heard the Jewish Zionist narrative. So when you hear it for the first time, it's kind of shocking. So we kind of moved from the akal el akaved, from the easier to the more complicated. But our method was to do it with good facilitators who train people to listen and do empathetic listening, so that you could hear some difficult things without, you know, yelling back at the other person, "You're wrong," or "You got it all wrong." And by the time you kind of finished the process, you understood that the other side has their own historical narratives and personal narratives, and so you learned a lot through getting to know people as well.
You know, this was a very exciting process, and in many ways maybe a much easier process to do when the political movement of the Oslo process was in place. It has not gotten easier since then.
True, very true.
What has changed in the dialogue process, and what do you see going forward?
First of all, if you're correct, our work started in the early 90s and paralleled Oslo. I often say in the good old ancient 1990s, people had...
Back in the 20th century, the ancient century.
Century. Way back then,
yeah.
People had political hope, and there was... 1993, there was euphoria in Israel that peace was possible. It was a totally new concept. And so there were a lot of people in the early 90s, throughout the 90s, I would say, entering into dialogue. Since the second Intifada 2000, and now it was going on 17 years of kind of downhill, first of all, less people are coming because they're more afraid, and they say, why bother? And when they do come, people's baggage, the amount of things that have happened on both sides has grown so intensively, it gets harder to talk about things. So many people have given up, and they say, we can't do it now, and we'll wait till, till peace comes. And we didn't give up. We kept going on the difficult times. And the way we continued to do it was to press the point of listening carefully to the other and really trying to understand where the other was coming from, and then try to look for some common ground. Where could we work together on things, not on the political front, but on the educational front and social things, where we could make some progress and feel that we were not totally useless. So it was important for us to try to seek ways to move from dialogue to action and not just to sit around and talk.
Obviously, you're not the only voice in the field. We know that the educational process, for example, among Palestinians, not within Israel but in the West Bank or Gaza, has included lots of textbooks that were kind of awful about Judaism and about Israel. How do you deal with those kinds of criticisms? Look, here you're trying to do all this positive stuff, but there's all these awful things going on.
There's a lot of stuff going on all the time, and there's a lot of fear going on all the time, and there's a lot of threats of the third Intifada all the time. So there's a lot of negative stuff around, and the challenge is not to give in to despair, but to somehow keep the flicker of hope alive and keep going. I think we do this by finding people on the grassroots who don't want to give into despair and are looking for ways to hook up with the other. Despite everything that you read, I can tell you that there are lots of Palestinians that I know in East Jerusalem and the West Bank and all over Israel who are interested, for, I would say, very pragmatic reasons of continuing the dialogue with the Jews. They want to move ahead. They want to get along on things. So in Israel, there's a strong urge of Palestinian Arabs to integrate into Israeli society, to have more equal rights and civil rights at the same time that they want to see a Palestinian state for their brothers and sisters next door. So one has to work hard not to give up and to seek partners who want to look towards the future. That's what we've tried to do.
Jerusalem is an incredible place. It's unique in the world, spectacular, filled with spiritual energy of all kinds, and also, of course, a flashpoint for a religious conflict. You are located there. You know Jerusalem. The view, as you say, comes from Jerusalem. It's hard not to think about Jerusalem. There's always something in the news, whether it's about the Temple Mount or the Western Wall or something. How is it being in that, I don't want to say pressure cooker, that's not quite right, but that extraordinary place in which all of this comes together so intensely?
Well, you know, people talk about the heavenly Jerusalem and the earthly Jerusalem. There are some days where you feel the heavenly and some days you don't, and some days the earthly is a little too exciting. I think when you get beyond some of the headlines, you find in Jerusalem an awful lot of interreligious coexistence. There are a lot of groups, tens of groups on the Palestinian and on the Jewish side who are working together doing quiet things that don't have to do with the Temple Mount controversy, which made a lot of headlines back in July. So you look for the good. There's a great system of schools called Hand in Hand, which has a wonderful bilingual school in Jerusalem now, and it's getting more and more publicity. We try to promote things there. And you look for, I have built wonderful dialogue partners, Christian dialogue partners, Muslim dialogue partners, from East to West Jerusalem, that often don't make the headlines. And you do what you can, and you educate in your schools, and you do educational and spiritual work together. And much of this, much of our work is off the radar. Is not headline capturing. I sometimes I wish we could make a little more news, but the news, you know, we're not a hot story. We don't kill anybody. We don't have any scandal. So we're not a hot news item. But we are doing more, and I'm encouraging other groups to do more on social networking. Even things like we're doing now, more podcasting, more people knowing about these things that don't make, you know, front page stories, which are limited. Helps to know that a lot of people live together in a strong spirit of coexistence. And if you've ever been to Jerusalem, people have ever had to go to the hospital, you find Jews and Arabs, doctors, nurses, and everybody working side by side. It's an amazing feeling, despite some of the news that you hear about the Temple Mount or whatever going on. So it's not on fire. It's not Syria. It's not Lebanon. It's tense. But you have to work through the tension, and you can find partners to do it.
You know, good news doesn't usually go viral. I want to thank Rabbi Ron Kronish for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Feels too short. We'll have to do it again. His new book is called The Other Peace Process, Interreligious Dialogue, A View from Jerusalem. You can get it on Amazon, of course.
Available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Where can people go to find out more about you and about interreligious dialogue?
Now, I just started my own website. Just put in my name and Ron Kronish Programs. It's called, it's part of the new Israeli thing called Wix. WIX, it's a new startup. I started it a few months ago. You can find everything there. Thank you.
Mazel tov on your new website. Thank you, Ron. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rotem Malach of the World Zionist Organization, speaking about a very important but not very well-known institution, the Israeli Supreme Court. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from our house rock band, Avanim. Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha, great peace of those who love the Torah. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shalom Rav Le'ohavei Toratecha. Shalom Rav. Shalom Rav Ve'en Lamo. Ve'en Lamo.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.